Let's simply begin again. My name is Don Hines. This is my wife, Linda. And I made a bad joke yesterday that went by, the silence was very leaden. I'm going to have a number of tales, which Linda will read, and I have a number of comments, which I'm going to be relating. The comments derive from a chapter, which I'm, another chapter, on this book manuscript I'm doing. So, Monday, we gave a presentation in which we simply located where the tribes used to live. Now, I'm dealing with what I call the Inland Pacific Northwest. The anthropologists call this the Plateau region. And it's simply going to be this line from the Cascades eastward over to the Bitterroots, which would be the eastern side of Idaho. Bitterroots, which are the range just this side of the Rocky Mountains. And going from the Blue Mountains, south of Walla Walla, Pendleton, northward above the Canadian border. Now, I call this the Inland Pacific Northwest. It's an area about 300 by 500 miles. Now, I've had some arguments on this, but I believe the area is vast enough we could just about stuff both East and West Germany into it. It's a little large, you see. Now, there were 28 tribes living there. And as I'll mention again and again, most of these have been very badly analyzed, discussed, or not discussed at all. And so the tribes, many of them have disappeared completely. We have remaining in the region 7 reservations. And these are mostly consolidated tribes. So if you go to the Yakima Reservation, which is the next one south, that's where you'll find the Yakima, the Klickitat, the Kittitas, according to the Treaty of 1870, you should be finding such tribes as the Chelan, Wenatchee, Mitau, Entiat, and so forth. All right. Yesterday, what we did was examine some of the cultural details, what it's like for these Indians to live according to their day-to-day life. And this was simply what they ate, what they lived in by way of their summer or their winter houses, how they hunted or fished, and the like. Now, we didn't finish. And what I will do then is to pick up today with the shaman, and then we will very quickly get into the main business today, is the oral literature. An oral literature. Now, we have to realize that one of the reasons these tribes have disappeared is they were not literate. They couldn't read nor write, and they had no need to. Their children were taught, were educated quite well for what need they had through oral means, simply word of mouth. And so their tales constitute for us, if we have any that were recorded, the most extraordinary available resource on how to get into these people's minds. I keep using the figure of speech. We are what we eat. And according to the tales, what we tell, we see how we think. And so we begin. One of the most fascinating individuals within each tribal group of the region was the shaman or medicine man, and his magical powers and rituals still intrigue us today. Among Indians of the Inland Pacific Northwest, both men and women served as shamans, but men predominated. Beginning about age 25, there was a return to the individual of that guardian spirit. Remember, we talked about the guardian spirit yesterday. At age 7, boys and girls, very, very superstitious, afraid of the dark, were taken perhaps 2 or 3 days' journey from home and were set on a mountaintop. And they must stay there for several days or until they'd had a vision. They were allowed no fire. They couldn't eat. They had to stay awake all the time. Only thing they did was build a stone cairn. And if they had a vision of an eagle or something, then they could finally come home, because the eagle would teach them a song, and would provide that mark of success whereby they were had become adult. Okay, now at age 25, with the revisitation of this guardian spirit then, the young men or women were tutored in shamanistic secrets by aged practitioners from the tribe. Now, particularly heaven-dwelling guardian spirits, especially in animals capable of bearing special messages or spirit songs from on high, marked the shaman to be. And strangely enough, we call these in literature or anthropology today simples. They are, in effect, devices which extend the power of the god. And the eagle was a very famous one here, and it's a small world, but the symbol of the ancient pagan god in Greece, Zeus, was also the eagle. Powerful and dangerous guardian spirits were grizzly bear, wolf, cougar, and especially weasel. And these, of course, were possessed then by malignant shamans, those who only did bad. At the winter dance, the revisitation of guardian spirits to particular tribal members was celebrated. At this dance, other shamans might display the special powers granted them and also stage power contests, magic contests with each other. But great care had to be exercised, for Indian belief held that guardian spirit powers of the younger individuals was to be preferred. The youngest medicine man, his guardian spirit was fresher, therefore stronger, more effective. Stay away from the old ones, you see. They had a very weak spirit. Their cure wasn't really that possible. All right? Overuse, that was the problem. Overuse would weaken spirit power, and the shaman thus would lose his effectiveness. But such a power contest occurs between shamans in the Nez Perce tale of how a water ball was made. A water ball.
You know the sweat house, how it was made, how the rocks are first heated and then put into the small hole in the ground just inside the doorway, how water must be brought and sprinkled on these hot stones to make a fog for the sweat. Three men had the rocks hot all ready for the sweat. Then they found they had no water basket to bring water from the lake. They must try their power to see who could bring the water. One man took an open woven basket all full of holes and dipped it into the lake. He brought the basket full of water and set it down at the sweat house. He had a strong power. Another man took a dip net used to catch fish and, going to the lake, dipped into the water and brought it filled and sat it by the basket that had been filled. The water did not leak out. The last man must now try his power. He waded into the lake until the water came above his knees. Then he began making a water ball, piling it up and shaping it with his hands. He made a round ball of water, large as a good-sized cooking basket. He lifted it to his shoulder, carried it to the sweat house, and sat it down by the basket and the dip net of the other men. The water ball held its shape, did not melt down. Then the man stuck his finger into it, and the water ran out. It was a great work. You do not know what power this man possessed? I will tell you. When a small boy, he was sent out somewhere in a lonely place to try to find power from something. The seal came and talked to him. It told him to do as it was telling him, and when he should be grown up, he would have this power to handle the water. Inside the fish, inside the seal, is the sac or air bladder, which you can take out. It was given the fish and the seal to help them handle themselves in the water. They blow it up with air. Land animals do not have this, and it was this power given by the seal to the boy when alone in the night darkness. No other man had such power as did this man.
Now, several shamans might serve each Indian village. These shamans were individuals of prestige who were well paid for the services. Some tendency was evident among the Indians to render payment only if a cure was effected. Not only were shamans schooled in appropriate magic songs and formulae, but a shaman to be had to be capable of self-induced trances. More, a practical knowledge of useful curative herbs and a useful knowledge of medical treatments such as splints for broken limbs, plus the virtues of heat, completed the education of the youthful shaman. Besides curing, the shaman had other tasks to do: casting spells on order, finding lost articles, laying or neutralizing ghosts by means of pipe-smoking ceremonies, arranging love potions and charms, and then finally purifying the environs lately occupied by the dead. The shaman was apparently a very pragmatic individual who was quite aware that use would weaken his guardian spirit power. A weakened spirit power would likely lead to the death of his patients and to a resultant loss of public confidence in him. Therefore, the shaman had to be able to recognize quickly those patients who were beyond his or any other's help and to pass them by. Perhaps after sprinkling water 4 times around the patient, the power doctor might simply pronounce the patient as beyond help. Each shaman cured illnesses in general, and no specialization was evident. However, some Indian power doctors possessed greater proficiency in the treatment of certain kinds of ills according to their particular guardian spirit. For instance, a shaman possessing the guardian spirit of rattlesnake or spider could best treat or and handle and even be bitten by a snake without suffering harm. And the spider guardian spirit enabled discovery of spider bites without the patient removing his clothes. To maintain acceptance by his public, the shaman displayed the power of his guardian spirit through seances. Usually, the shaman would wait for a patient's family to call upon him and to bring a present. The larger present, the more persuaded the shaman might be to effect a cure. Now, the illnesses afflicting the region's Indians, very briefly, can be grouped into 2 categories. First, there were natural illnesses, such as headaches, colds, injuries from accidents, and the Indians readily recognized as incurable such diseases as tuberculosis, syphilis, and sore eyes. These were readily observable to the practitioner. Second, there were unnatural diseases. And these diseases, at least 2 varieties, were caused by the patient being possessed by an evil spirit. And the task of the shaman was to cast that evil spirit from the body of the patient, perhaps to take it within himself, to then render it from himself, to deposit it in water, and therefore to render it harmless. Medical diagnosis of these power doctors was much niftier than today. The patient was never required to disrobe. The disease, the site of the injury, was always located through the patient's clothing, and actual treatment was usually inflicted upon the doctor's body, who he would frequently come away literally black and blue, and the cure then related to the patient. Still another variety of illness. I'm missing some pages. See if we can find 18. It should be in the other. Still another variety of illness was caused by a disease projectile that would come to lodge in the body. And what the shaman simply had to do was to locate the disease object and to expel it. And once it was expelled, to simply, as if to tear it up into small bits and cast it into the air. Now, thereby rendering it harmless. Now, this is very curious to me, because I had a class not too many years back taught by Carl Hermann Tilhagen of Skansen Museet in Stockholm. And a very dominant belief amongst the Swedish folk rests in the fact that diseases can often be called by what they call the thin shot. The thin shot. The Germans have a much fancier scientific name, the Krankheitsprojektil. Those Laplanders, you gotta watch them, those dour, dark-browed individuals sitting up near the Arctic Circle would shoot these diseased darts, you see. And they would inflict individuals, and in this way, you see, the folk would explain such things as migraine headaches, you see, starting down here in the neck, you see, and working up over the head and causing intense pain. The shaman had the ability also to employ what we would probably call rapping, table tipping, in the way of these shows of magic. They had tamana wash sticks, approximately 2 feet in length, perhaps inch or 2 inches in diameter, which they, according to many witnesses, would cause to dance, simply to be dancing vertically up and down. And they would, the shamans would invite the audience to grasp the sticks, to attempt to hold them down. And the pull of the magic was so strong that individuals would literally be thrown onto their backs because the sticks were dancing with such force as to prevent them from being stopped. Now, with considerable chagrin, I find that the conclusion in which George B. Kuykendall, first medical doctor ever to minister to the Yakimas, witnessed the dying of a Yakima chieftain's daughter. And the final death scene and the intimate play of the Indian magic is detailed. And somehow it has gotten away from us. And that'll have to be a seminar another time. He is called in, and she's dying of typhoid. We'll have to summer. It's a safe time anyway. And she is very obviously, he takes her pulse, and she's on her deathbed. The machinery of life, as he puts it, is soon to cease. Around her, the people are doing the healing dance, which is simply a stepping on the ball of the foot and then stepping back in sort of a jerking motion onto the heel, with sort of a lurch, step lurch, step lurch, going round and round, and they're singing. And it's a doleful sort of thing that if you saw the films that we played the first day, pretty much reminiscent of that. It's very, very, to the foreign white ear, we can't hear the music. And the there's someone about 2 feet away from the girl is ringing a small bell. And the girl began speaking, and of course, Kuykendall did not understand Yakima tongue, and so translated. As he's taking her pulse, of course, the girl is waving her hands in time with the drumming. And she insisted the doctor join her. And he's very adamant because he's not only a medical doctor, and this is all trash that he's seeing. You see, the Indians attempting to cure typhoid without vaccination, you see, without our modern magic bullet wonder drugs. But he's a good Christian, and he's not going to have truck with his paganism. But finally, he's entreated and entreated, and, you know, she's on her deathbed. So finally, he says, out of pity that he did. And the girl then began to speak further. And the fact, she had this vision. Now, we don't operate by visions these days, and we have to find this very, very strange. But when a people's total life sphere is actuated by visions, but she said she was going to die and in that very afternoon would be with the Great Spirit. That she could hear the wondrous ringing of a bell announcing her entry into the next world. And she saw her departed brethren, her relatives and so forth, beckoning there that she would join in, that she would join them soon. And it was a marvelous, marvelous, very pleasant experience. And then with that, she died. And Kuykendall, shaking his head then, records in his journal, his diary, the fact that what a pity for such a primitive people. Well, the fascinating thing for me, here we are in the 20th century, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, author of On Death and Dying, has just now been among the first to discover this vision, this presentiment on the approach of death, this sense of prior, what do we call it? The prior experience, you see. People, when they're brought back, when they revive, there is this sense of detachment. And here's this Indian girl, already in this vision, reporting on it. It's utterly fascinating. Well, one of the things I mentioned from last time, we're reading and summarizing much of this material, and I do so out of a very great appreciation for your bearing with us, and I do so only with the understanding that at any time you interrupt with questions. It gives me a chance to rest and keeps me from drinking all of my coffee cold, and so on.
Did the Indians believe in reincarnation?
They had a sense of immortality. Coyote, in his guise, we'll get into that in just a minute, in his guise as a demigod, lost immortality for them, and as a result brought death.
That's one tale we didn't read yesterday. We ran out of time, but there is a story that's common to all of the tribes of the region that they had a chance at one time to be immortal. That the Great Spirit gave Coyote, in various guises, he gave him a pack to carry over five mountains, and he wasn't to open it till he got over the last mountain. But he got so lonesome for his friends, or he got so weary in another one, or the pack was so heavy, that just before he went over the last mountain, he opened it, and the spirits all flew back to the other world. And immortality was lost to the Indian tribes. But they have a number of interesting stories where live people go to the spirit land. As you drive down the Columbia, you come to a Memaloose Island, the island of the dead. And Kuykendall has some very interesting myths and stories about the island of the dead, about the woman who went out because her lover was there to the island of the dead. And the Indians were very much afraid of being there at night, and they would hear noises at night from the island of the dead. And they believed, as related in their tales, that at night the dead became alive again. They built their campfires, they had a marvelous time, they sang, they danced, they saw all their old friends.
Yeah.
And in the daytime, you would wake up if you were on the island and you would be surrounded by bones.
Yeah.
It was very eerie. And many of their tales relate of Coyote doing this. He tries to go back, and at night, everything is wonderful. Everyone's alive again.
Yeah.
But in the daytime, you wake up and you're either surrounded by desolation or by bleached bones.
Yeah. There's sort of an ambivalence. Death, on the one hand, is terrifying. But then there's this twinge, you see, with, you know, at night, you know, we have barbecue, sing the old songs, and have a perfectly lovely
time. It's a really fine place.
Yes.
There's Memaloose Island in Lake Monterey, right off of where David Thompson and Finn McDonald had that trading posts on Hope, and I wondered if sometimes corrupted Mammaloose, but I think it's better than Mammaloose.
It's generally a burial ground, a burial place for the dead. And
one of the curious things, we were 2 years ago down at Hell's Canyon, and the Forest Service, perhaps unwittingly, elected to name the landing strip Memaloose Landing Strip. I can't think of it. Worst name they could have. Yes, sir.
Talking about the spirits that these young people, the visions they're supposed to have, have been any theorizing that possibly those were hallucinations brought on by the lack of sleep and the lack of food to their facilities?
Yeah. It was a cultural expectation that each of the kids have one, And as I remarked, not everyone got it the first time. Some people had as many as two guardian spirits visit them, but one out of every 10, although they went back numerous times, failed completely. And so they went through life, you know, as singularly marked as
There are some difficult things to explain, and the people, the Indians who had these powers, there were people who were particularly skilled in certain areas. Now, whether they developed this skill because they thought they had this particular spirit, and therefore developed hunting skills and hunting the deer, or whether they had it for other reasons. But I know Yellow Wolf very strongly believed that his guardian spirit was protecting him, and he depended very much upon his medicine pouch and on the tokens of his guardian spirit being with him at all times.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of cultural stereotype, perhaps they inflicted on themselves. It's much like today. Blacks have natural rhythm, good voices, and are tremendous jocks. Well, they essentially have body types, gifts, geniuses, the same as we do. But that cultural stereotype means that more of them are pushed into that mold, and so one thing and another, lo and behold, they do sing and have rhythm, and so on. So it's a fascinating thing to speculate on.
Mm-hmm. I have a question on the magic. I get a little confused as to whether some of the things are just that you're describing are merely in tales, or they really exist, like the dancing sticks and that sort of thing. I mean, was this something
that, really
that the shamans were really able to do? And if so, how in the world did they pull it off?
We don't know. We don't know. See,
and these are accounts by skeptical whites.
Yeah.
They went in believing it was all a lot of nonsense and that it couldn't happen. And yet Kuykendall records some things that he clearly can't explain. And we've talked to other people who will not write these things down. But the Blue Jay dancers, for example, these people supposedly in a trance and in the Blue Jay dancing had the ability to put themselves on tops of buildings, on tops of lodges, to fly. And there are people who will tell us that they have seen this happen. They're Indian people. But they're very reliable people, and it's something that simply can't be explained. And Kuykendall found things he just couldn't explain. They couldn't hold on to these sticks, and I don't...
So what he does is simply dismiss it, as we might with a session with an Ouija board. Well, it's so much rapping and table tipping, you see. Well, you see.
But not if there's nothing holding on to the stick.
Yeah, see, well, it's... That's the whole thing. We come away, we have to come away with a bit more respect for the culture. And again, our context within these three sessions now is to approach an understanding of the Indian today. I mean, he is the largest minority within the region. Increasingly, the church, I believe, is going to be called upon to minister to his particular needs and so forth, and we can do so only if we have knowledge of him.
And their visions are another thing that are interesting, because they had visions of war coming. They had visions of white. There's one body of information about the Indian who foretold the coming of the whites before there was ever a white, because he saw a vision and he saw very clearly what was going to happen to his people. And he warned them about this. And their sense of visions and dreams is very strong. And I don't know, we don't hear about the inaccuracies, but the accuracies are recorded very well in the literature, both by whites and by Indians.
Perhaps this is something that can be in anyone, but just our culture just does not tolerate such things.
And their
any
culture
tendencies
developed.
Of our children, you know, the fantasy and the children, starting with the children, oh, that's ridiculous, and it's sort of thwarted from a very early age.
Well, as we get,
That's right.
Get into the tales, we see this is one problem we have now in trying to recover these. When the white culture came into contact with the Indian, their tales, their stories that they told were ridiculed as child's play, as something not worth preserving. And this was picked up early by the Indians who had contact with the whites, and pretty soon they wouldn't tell them anymore because they thought, you know, here's a grown man telling his son stories like this. Mm-hmm. And it was child's play, and to them it was not. It was the serious way of carrying on their culture to the next generation.
That again, I would plead, as we read these tales, particularly in this next segment now, at the one level, they are indeed entertaining, but really, it's far more fascinating to examine them within a context, because they actually provide a device by which the kids were educated. These were the devices for their education. And so much cultural content and rationale is in them. Jim, you got a question?
Yeah, the since their whole life is essentially centered around hallucinations and visions and that other world, is that probably one of the reasons why alcohol is such a dangerous thing to a society? The fact that they could start contriving these same types of things by drinking more alcohol.
Yeah. I the literature now is very limited, and for this material I've scoured everything. I find no evidences that they brewed materials.
You mean when the whites brought them alcohol?
Yes.
Or this was destructive.
Okay. Yeah.
Probably the destructive tendency of the alcohol was more because it broke down the family structure and it broke down the authority structures in the bands.
Yeah.
So that, we'll read a segment here where a chief talks about what happened when the whites brought alcohol to his young men.
Yeah. Alcohol was it smoothed over the extraordinary hurt when you look around and your society is simply coming unglued. One of the most pathetic individuals, of course, was Chief Gary of the Spokanes, who in his lifetime was a very prideful individual ruling over a country that had no whites in it. But then the whites came. And he was a very intelligent man who heeded the missionaries, Christianized, and then there is this sort of coexistence. But then the third segment comes now when the whites become the larger, more dominant group. And he looks around and he sees the city coming, the waters, the spoiled, the land fenced, so the nomadic traits of the Indians are shunted off. And he became a very, very bitter man and very alcoholic, very much an alcoholic.
He was also so helpful to the whites.
Yeah.
He helped them to protect themselves. He helped them to find food. He helped them to find places where they could get fish and so on. He told them about how to survive in the region. He had his people help them. And one of the most distressing speeches is one that he gave standing outside of his teepee on the edge of Spokane when he'd been driven off his land and even his teepee area was being harassed by kids and dogs. And he looks around at the land that he once knew with no whites on it. And now he is pleading for the Spokane Indians to at least be given a reservation. They were one of the last to be given even a spot of ground that they could call their own. He pleaded at first for the Spokane Falls area, and then he pleaded for any place, just so that they would at least have a small segment where they could stand without being harassed by the whites.
Yes, ma'am.
This might digress a little bit, but I don't know whether you've ever heard of the artist Brownell McGrew of Emmaus Lutheran Church of Alhambra, California. And he loved the Indians so much, and he moved to the desert, and he paints some of the most magnificent pictures of Indian life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's becoming a very fine artist, and he also paints Christian pictures, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, a Lutheran artist that has become quite well known already, I think, is quite a wonderful thing.
Right.
And he's
right.
advancing our knowledge of the Indians to a point in pictures. I think
right.
it's lovely.
Right. Right.
Now, one of the things I think that's going to be really helpful is as we get more authentic things published about their culture and come to understand what was important to them. So many of the tribes of the Inland Empire have absolutely nothing published about their culture. And even the Indians who'd gone off the reservation and now coming back are asking, you know, where can we relearn what it meant to be a Nez Perce? And so one of the things we're hoping to do is working with them to publish these things. And the tribes are more and more trying to publish materials themselves.
And you can do it through painting.
And you can do it through painting.
That's right. That's right.
To make us more aware of how it is that they live. One of the most interesting parts of their culture is the whole tale-telling tradition. And so I think it might be interesting to go get on to reading some of their tales because it gives a real insight into how they thought and what was important and what was funny to them. How they entertained themselves.
Right.
The studied as a whole, traditional tales of Indians of the Inland Pacific Northwest reveal a regional style. Shared traits of form and content appear in the oral literature from all across the region. Comparable details of character and even the same culture heroes appear again and again. Distinctive local fauna and flora mark the region's tales. Unfortunately, collecting of the Indians' oral literature was begun late, mostly in the 20th century. Then, during the mid-1930s, comprehensive tale collecting among Indian tribes of the region faltered and came to a halt. A search of libraries in the region yields now few volumes of reliably edited and published texts. Few of the 28 Indian nations of the region have had some record made of their oral literature. Most have been totally ignored and neglected. And now, social trends towards city life, the serious decline of the oral tribal languages, and the disappearance of the old-time raconteurs, or storytellers, have made any authentic revival of tribal oral literature impossible in many situations. From what material has been collected and reliably recorded, we learn that the entire corpus of oral literature formerly extant among the area's Indian nations included songs, religious songs, martial songs, and random others. There were also prayers. There was also a vigorous tradition of oratory. There are a number of historical narratives that are to be found. We have tales of personal adventure of the hunt. And finally, and most particularly here, the tales and myths. In the past, search after only myths was the focus of scholars, and as a result, whole areas of the oral literature of the region's Indians was overlooked. And to make matters worse, by the mid-1930s, many of the Indian languages were already severely decayed or rapidly forgotten, so that field workers recorded the products of erratic memories and diminished raconteurs. Fortunately, numerous tales remain among some of the raconteurs within each tribal culture. To facilitate the transformation of these tales from the oral telling to our printed media, explicit categories can be created, and accordingly, the following groupings enable us to approach these Indian oral narratives. First, we have mythic tales. Now, mythic tales, they're passed on only by word of mouth. We don't know who developed them, but they constitute those tales which are primarily set in a former world, a world before history, and account for the origins of animals, plants, humans, ritual, or phenomena. Secondly, there are trickster tales. Now, trickster tales depict the godlike coyote and his mischievous, even destructive pranks. Thirdly, there are tales of other culture heroes, and include accounts of animal beings upon whom the Indians looked with considerable reverence. Fourth, tales of the marvelous, in which marvelous adventures are set forth or wondrous accomplishments by particular animals. These were apparently designed to entertain while perhaps recounting of guardian spirit animals. Fifth, hunting tales detail the extraordinary bravery of surviving, often badly crippled warriors who engaged in ferocious bouts of knife and claw, single-handed combat with the grizzly, which once ruled this region. Sixth, tales comparable to European forms include at least six versions which are wrongly thought of as solely European, but versions of the Aesopian race of a bull with a frog, in which the lesser, weaker, slower animal inevitably wins. It's a small world. Finally, monsters of the region reflect the imagination of the people and explanations of the inexplicable and the secular by assigning anthropomorphic bases for such things as thunder, lightning, and disease. Anthropomorphic, in a large word, which simply means they provide for what to them their science did not enable, simply animal causation, an evil spirit causation, and this way some sort of explanation so as to defang the inexplicable. Appreciation and close study of any body of American oral narratives must begin with the performance of the raconteur and the dynamic interrelationship between the tribal tale teller and his audience. It is evident formally that no single professional tribal raconteur plied his art across the region. Instead, gifted individuals were known in each tribal band. For instance, Mourning Dove collected the oral narratives which appear in Tales of the Okanagan from her mother, her father, and several acquaintances. Familiar with tribal stories from her youth on, she went straight to the best raconteurs she could find. She was encouraged by L.V. McWhorter, an amateur ethnologist, formerly of Yakima, or late of Yakima, Washington, and applied precepts from the Bureau of American Ethnology to her collecting, seeking after the most told version, attempting to be precise rather than ornamentative in her translations. Now again, the interesting thing, I'm fascinating to hear her brokering create stories. We have an entirely different situation here where it's a retelling with incredible fidelity, again and again, the same old story, because you have this high degree of conservatism amongst the Indians, and that the best way to tell a story is to take this story text, which has been time-tried, time-tested, and been found to be absolutely entertaining or instructive, and to repeat it verbatim. Now, it's always passed on by word of mouth, see. And it is not, as we often read it, to be rendered as a short story. The best way to render any oral literature these days, to write it up in a book, is as of a dramatic monologue, because that's essentially what it was, you see. Now, another very superb informant, a storyteller, was the mother of Archie Finney, Wailatpu, or Mrs. Fitch Finney. She wasn't conversant with the English language hardly at all. Her son tells us that she was extraordinarily gifted with a fabulous memory, an acute command of the Nez Perce, and could take these stories and could tell them extraordinarily well with great, great fidelity. And then her son, working under Franz Boas back at Columbia about 1930, translated them into English in his very scholarly book, Nez Perce Texts.
What's
yes.
The name,
Wailatpu? Wailatpu.
Wailatpu.
Yeah.
Okay,
third syllable. Third syllable. Wailatpu translates as the ryegrass country, yeah, and was the site of the Whitman mission.
Right. That's right. What I wondered.
Yeah. Third syllable. See. Yes. A third tale teller was Mrs. Ella Wilson. We have some tapes of her telling. And the high degree in which she enters into the tale, she's creating the voices of the animal characters, there's the cadence, the movement of the story. They are totally engrossing. It's a one-person, one-act dramatic piece. Mourning Dove recalls that Indian myths were told from one generation to another by the storytellers. It was their business to go from teepee to teepee, telling the ancient stories of the animal world. The storytellers went from one Indian encampment to another to tell the stories, the tales to their people, both old and young. And they were welcomed at every fireside to do their work. Vividly, I recalled old Lost Head, I'm going to omit the Indian word, also known as old Narcisse, and how in the course of a narrative, he would jump up and mimic his characters, speaking or singing in a strong or weak voice, just as the animal persons were supposed to have done. and he would dance around the fire in the tule mat-covered lodge until the pines rang with the gleeful shouts of the smallest listeners. We thought of this as all fun and play, hardly aware that the tale-telling and impersonations were a part of our primitive education. Another favorite was Broken Nose Abraham. He was old and crippled. He came to our village usually on a white horse, riding double with his blind wife, who held the reins and guided the horse at his direction. It always thrilled us to see Broken Nose ride into camp. He had a stock of such fascinating stories. Broken Nose could not dance for us. He could not even walk without the support of his two canes. But he sang exciting war songs, and we liked to sing with him. Some of the women were noted storytellers, but they never made it a business to go from village to village to tell them. We children would go to them. I particularly remember Big Lip, or Old Jenny, or Long Theresa, and my maternal grandmother, whose Indian name translates, "She got her power from the water." I love these simple, kindly people, and I think of them often. And in my memory, I treasure the picture of my dear mother who, when I was a very little girl, made the bedtime hours happy for me with the legends she told. She would tell them to me until I fell asleep. Two that are in this collection, Fisher and Martin, An Origin of Mosquito, she told over and over again, and I never grew tired of hearing them. My father always enjoyed telling the old stories, and he does still. He and Toma Martin are among the few men and women left who can tell the Chip-Chop Tequilk or old stories, and I thank them for helping me. Now, I've got some pictures of Mourning Dove in the front of this book. You want to pass it around, please?
I'm going to put it this way.
Yeah, okay, that's right. The Mourning Dove, or Humashumi, her Indian name, or Mrs. Fred Galler, had only a third grade education. She's a Lake Indian, which would be on the eastern side, residing on a portion of the eastern side of the Colville Reservation today. Now, she was born about 1910, and she somehow managed to get a business education one summer in Spokane when she was about 18. Now, she married, her husband that she married was a very, very erratic sort. But Mourning Dove was a unique, gifted individual who was fired with zeal to preserve her tribal heritage. And so she got herself a typewriter. And on the back of an old, old Dodge touring car, and I have all of her letters, they would follow the harvests. They would prune apple trees up in this region. Now, she comes from Colville area. They would go up to Canada working, but her typewriter went with her, and in the dust, the smoke, and the perpetual noise of the Indian camp, as soon as her chores were done, she went on with her her telling of recording of these tales. She would go to people, hear them, hear the tales told, would come back, and with her typewriter, make the translation from the Indian into the language, into English. Now, I discovered these tales in the WSU archives, that and some of her penciled materials. Now, she started doing this about 1916, 1918. Now, the tales by this time are, the paper is yellow, and the material is written in pencil, is literally fading off the page. And this gives me panic, because we've got to get these things into English before they completely vanish, literally vanish in the archives. Likewise, Angus Wilson recalls of his mother, and also that his grandmother told tales well to his brothers, sister, and himself. Nez Perce tale telling of the past, and detailed when he said, "At bedtime the children would all beg, 'Tell us a story, Grandma.' And snug in bed they would listen intently, saying in the Nez Perce, 'E, E,' in the darkness. And 'E' translates literally into English, 'Uh-huh, uh-huh.' And my grandmother's voice imitated the gruff voice of Hahatsnim, or grizzly bear, and the high-sounding voice of Tiska, or skunk. In the deepening gloom, she gestured and acted out for us some of the traits of the characters and their actions of the story. At last, there were no more E's to be heard from us, and we had all fallen asleep, and so the storytelling ended until the next night. Telling Nez Perce legends within family circles is something I've tried to continue with my own sons. When They were little boys. I told them the old legends, but in English, for they don't understand the Nez Perce. In this way, I have tried to continue the story and cultural traditions of my father, and particularly my mother and grandparents. So many of the old tales have now been forgotten, and the old places or events which were associated with the legends are no longer known. Legends are hollow unless there is something behind them. The mythic narratives of the region's Indians reveal some common traits. First of all, the action occurs in the time previous to the present or historical time. The sample text hereafter identifies the mythic time as prior to the age of man, when the animal people ruled. And in this one, the animal people are dying of starvation. At the close of the narrative, the story declares that soon the people, meaning the Indians, will come. This is always a device by which the story begins, or closes, rather. It is interesting that an examination of the corpus of the tales of the region reveals few creation accounts. No tales detail how the world was created, and only a few explain the origins of plants or animals or people. The tales assume, evidently, that the things as they are were always so. The Yakima tribes do have some stories of a great flood, but this betrays the possibility that the story may have been the product of missionaries long ago, and which has been caught up in the pagan tale traditions. Particular locales of the tales are especially regional. In our example, the tale speaks of a dam. Now, the dam is located near an ocean, but from the vantage point of Indians dwelling hereabouts on the Columbia River near the Canadian border, such a dam might well have been an explanation for the more than 20 miles of tortuous rapids which formerly were found between the Dalles and the Salado, Oregon region of the Columbia River, which was flooded, of course, and is no longer to be seen behind the Dalles Dam. The narrative alludes to the severe famine visited upon the region's Indians when the salmon spawning runs in the spring and fall were delayed. The tale explains how, through Coyote's role as a demigod or near god, salmon were assigned to spawn in some but not in all rivers of the region. This myth text comprises a charter of explanation. In the majority of mythic texts, Coyote is the chief actor, a culture hero. But Coyote fills two other roles later on, as trickster and as dupe. He's a fall guy. As culture hero, Coyote undertakes to work good on behalf of the animal people who will be coming soon. He employs his considerable magic to achieve his end. But Coyote is able to shape-shift or change his form. He can become a cooking basket, a crying infant, a feather, or a rock, then back again. In many of his exploits, Coyote is assisted by his brother, it's not a blood brother really, Fox. Usually Fox fares badly while traveling with Coyote because he's always being ridiculed and belittled. But when Coyote's tricks backfire and kill him, it is Fox who discovers and then revives Coyote with a magical expedient of straddling the pile of bones and whatever three times, stepping back and forth over three times, at which Coyote jumps up fully formed. Besides Coyote, other mythic heroes include Salmon, Chickadee, and perhaps Beaver. Finally, the mythic world contains animals or inanimate objects able to talk, to behave like people. We have the two snipe sisters. These snipe birds really are shaped as girls. They fish, they maintain a salmon dam, and they take in pitiable foundlings. And we have a floating cooking basket. We talked about the baskets yesterday. The basket is really Coyote in disguise. Or else the Coyote shaped as a crying infant, which suddenly appears in the fire. All this is solemnly accepted by the Indian audience and appreciated, and so we have the tale how Coyote broke the salmon dam.
The people were dying from starvation. The great monster deities of the warm land had built a mighty dam which closed the trail of the salmon coming up the Swanetqua, which is the Columbia River. This caused the people to dance the prayer dance day after day, night after night. They wanted to find out how to open the salmon trail so that their main source of food might come back to the rivers again, might reproduce in the mountain streams. Although they prayed and danced, none obtained power to break the dam. Coyote heard and came to the rescue of the famished people. He volunteered to go to the warm country and break the bridge of the monsters. The people were glad. Coyote started on his long journey to the warm land. After many sundowns, he drew near the dam, close to the big water, or ocean. Coyote now changed himself into a la'achin, or cooking basket, or food retainer. He got out upon the water and floated down the Suanetqua. There were two sisters, Snipe and Little Snipe, who watched the big dam for the monster deities. They killed many salmon as the fish came to the bridge or dam. The younger Snipe saw the la'achin first. She wanted to get it, but her sister refused. But Little Snipe begged all the more, and at last her sister let her swim out and get the la'achin, the small basket. This made Little Snipe very glad, and when they returned to their teepee, she used it as her eating dish. When she filled it with salmon, it would become empty before she knew it. Her sister scolded her for being so greedy. Little Snipe quit eating before she had enough, setting the la'achin away with food in it. But when she went for it, the food was all gone. It was always so. It was Coyote who ate the salmon. As the sundowns passed, the sisters grew suspicious of the la'achin. The older sister threw it on the fire. As the basket struck the fire, it turned into a baby boy, crying. Little Snipe begged her sister to keep the baby as a little brother. Older sister refused, but after many times refusing, she agreed to keep the baby as a little brother. The sundowns continued to come and go, and the baby brother grew rapidly. He was bright in actions. The Snipe sisters found much pleasure in playing with the baby. When they went to the dam to catch salmon, they would tie him to the teepee pole with a string. They were afraid that their little brother might fall into the Suanetqua. They did not know that as soon as they were gone, the baby would turn into the coyote that he was, and running to the upper side of the dam, he dug with all his might. He would dig until he thought it time for his sisters to be going back to the lodge. Then he would again be a baby tied to the teepee pole. For many sundowns, Coyote thus worked in secret. One morning, he saw that the breaking of the big bridge was near finishing. When his sisters went down to catch salmon, he took a lakwa, or wooden spoon, put it on his head, and set out to finish his work. As his paws scratched at the dirt, his sisters came back to the teepee. The string was there, but their little brother was gone. Little Snipe cried. They began looking for the baby and found the tracks of Coyote leading down to the dam. The sisters hurried to the dam only to find Coyote breaking it away. Snipe and her little sister took sticks and began striking Coyote over the head. But Coyote worked all the harder. They could not hurt him for the lakwa. The sisters in their excitement forgot to call the monsters, and before they knew it, the dam broke loose. The freed salmon started toward the snow country, swarming up the Suanetqua. Coyote took a staff and began the return journey to his own people, bringing with him a great hoard of salmon. He traveled for many sundowns. Coming to a branch of the Suanetqua, he stopped. Leaving part of his salmon there, he started up the Okanagan River with the rest of his herd. He traveled a long ways until he came to a branch of the Okanagan. There he divided his salmon herd, taking part of it up the Smilkameen River. Arriving in the Smilkameen or White Swan country, Coyote asked for a wife of the tribe, but the women whom he asked laughed at him. They said to Coyote, "We do not eat salmon which is ready to die. We are accustomed to eating only the back of the necks of the mountain goat." This insulted Coyote. He answered them, "You Smilkameen people, in the future you will go far to get the rotted salmon, as you call it." Coyote now turned back from the Smilkameen country, leaving it rough and rocky along the river. He left it so no trail could ever be made available for the people where he traveled. Leading his salmon back to the Okanagan, Coyote built a falls in the Smilkameen above its mouth. The salmon have never passed those falls. Coyote continued up the Okanagan in search of a wife. As he reached the outlet of the Sioux or Osoyoos Lake, he found a tribe of people. He asked for a wife. The people being hungry, they gave him a wife, and he let the salmon spawn and hatch in the narrows of the lake. The salmon breed their young there to this day. Coyote soon grew tired of his Sioux wife, and taking part of his salmon, continued up the Okanagan. When he reached the Penticton tribe, he asked for a wife and was promised one later. He left a few large salmon and went on up the Okanagan Lake to the Enkemplex tribe near Vernon, British Columbia.
But the Enkemplex only laughed at Coyote when he asked for a wife, and this angered Coyote. He said to them, "You will go far and sore-footed before you get your salmon." Coyote turned back down the Okanagan, bringing his salmon with him. When he reached the Penticton's, his intended wife had another man. Coyote left only the salmon which strayed off and came on down to Dog Lake. There he made a falls, Okanagan Falls in British Columbia, leaving the rest of this part of his salmon herd there to breed for his Okanagan wife. Coyote went back to the Swanetqua, where the largest of his salmon were. This is why no salmon reached the Smilkameen and Enkemplex people, while Penticton's have only a few strays to spawn for them. Coyote now traveled up the Swanetqua, leading his herd of big salmon towards the snow country.
The Swanetqua is the Columbia River.
Mm-hmm. He came to the San Paul River. He traveled up this river for a ways when he found an encampment of people. He asked the people for a wife, and they gave him a young maiden. Coyote was pleased. He stopped the salmon, part of the big red kind, to spawn and hatch there. Thus the San Paul tribe still enjoy the best of salmon as food. But Coyote grew tired of his San Paul wife, and taking part of his salmon, continued snowward up the Swanetqua. He came to the Arrow Lakes, where he found the Arrow tribe. Coyote asked for a wife, but the Arrow people laughed at him. They said, "We do not care for salmon. Our food is the good porcupine, which only the great mountains give us." Coyote spoke angrily, "After this, your tribe will tip many canoes in reaching where you can eat salmon." Coyote made the trails mountainous, rough, and rocky, leaving only a way for canoes to travel down the vicious many rapids of the river whose channel he formed. Coyote turned back down the Swanetqua till he came to the mouth of the Spokane. He went up this river to the Kalispell tribe, where he asked for a wife. The Kalispell laughed. They said, "We do not eat salmon. Our food is the good camas." Coyote became angry. He answered the Kalispells, "You will travel far and wear out many moccasins in trading your prized camas for salmon." Turning back down the river with his salmon, Coyote made a trap or falls in the river so the salmon could not pass. And this is Spokane Falls. Coyote continued back to the Swanetqua. He traveled till he came to the Enquapiqua, or Kettle River. Coyote went up this river in search of a new wife. When he reached Isiskachin, or Canyon Gulch, near Curlew, Washington, he found a village of people. He asked for a wife. The people laughed at him. They said, "We do not eat the rotted salmon which is ready to die from making eggs. We eat the fish of the river which is white." Coyote answered them, "All right. Your fish will always be white, but after this they will have many bones, the squawfish, and you will travel far to get the salmon." Coyote turned back down the river with his herd of salmon. He built the high falls of the Enquapiqua at Cascades, British Columbia. No salmon has ever passed these falls. Coyote reached Swanetqua, where he made a great waterfall, which is Kettle Falls, for his salmon. He did this after the people there had given him a handsome maiden as a wife. A large encampment, a big village, was built at this falls. Coyote said to these friends, "After this, people will come from the different tribes to beg salmon of you. They will bring many kinds of food to trade for your salmon." Soon Coyote forgot his charges, the salmon, and went on his way in search of more adventures. He left his salmon at the great Swanetqua Falls to come and make eggs there each year, left them where the people traveled from distant places to catch salmon as they come from the big water. It has been so since Coyote broke the great dam of the monster deities of the big waters back in the time of the animal people.
Again, as an explanation, you see, we have polygamy detailed here. We have, for the young Indian children, explanations which are provided them to the story of why salmon go here, but why salmon are not found there, and so forth. Jim?
How many of these tapes do you actually have, or is there a repository in which you are getting these tapes placed from the old tales told by the Indians?
Well, we have no tapes. These are all material.
Made more than just the one tape, and it's in the University of Idaho archives, and we have a copy of this tape. But it's a very fine tape. Unfortunately, most... Well, the old raconteurs who provided these tales are all dead. They were dead before we took up an interest in folklore. And we are right now trying to get the means to record those people who are left. and we're waiting now to hear if this will be possible. Otherwise, it's whatever we can do individually. No, yeah. There's been no collecting project to preserve these. We would like to preserve them on videotape. Yeah. But so far, we haven't been able to.
Other questions? Well, the next category of tale is the trickster narrative. And we find a number of these around, and the chief character is, again, Coyote. He was a very, very favored character among the Indians because it is a very wily, very, very intelligent animal. We have seen Coyote now, formerly in the last tale, in the guise of a god. Here he's out just to make mischief. And this story, Coyote is a beautiful woman. Coyote acts out a role which is destructive, and in the Indian narratives, frequently obscene. And this has to get into the Indian humor, which fortunately we won't. First, the motivation for the story, very, very common, and which has got to reflect on the culture. Coyote is hungry. He's always hungry and yawning, which is a sign always. And like the real animal, he seeks food. At the end of this narrative, he will be satisfied. And once the hunger is satisfied, another trait of the trickster coyote, he's always boasting. He's really, you want to sort of leave him alone and just get rid of him because he's unpleasant. As in folk tales the world over, the Indian tales depict coyote interacting with but one other character per scene, and usually this is coyote and fox. The plot is always single-stranded. We don't have any minor plots like in a highly developed novel, but it's straightforward, running to the conclusion, episodic sort of plot. The story is always told in terms of action. And unlike artful literature, metaphor, lurid description are not to be found. This is a marvelous thing. Description in oral literature rests on the verbs, and in art literature, always on the adjectives and adverbs. The main character, Coyote, always occupies the center stage. Without question, our attention falls on him, and there's an internal credibility. We accept without question, you see, what Coyote does, and we don't argue. It is quite one thing for both Coyote and Fox to hunger and to hunt and to tire, but that they return home from the hunt empty-handed calls to the imagination a vivid picture, perhaps born of real experience. But when Coyote costumes himself in the story as a very sexy Indian maiden in order to feast at the expense of Badger, we relish the prank. He not only dreams up, but he succeeds with the trick. And in the tale's final scene, Coyote displays the ultimate of human-like wiles. He has 4 packs of dried meat delivered to his teepee, and he imitates the voices of several oldsters in imaginary conversation, and while he devours the 4 packs of meat. Finally, very interestingly, the world of the Indian rests on the numbers 5, rather than, in our world, the number 3. Coyote will often make 5 attempts to do some deed, or will employ 5 stone knives to cut out the heart of a monster, or will ritually sweat for 5 days, or will face the onslaughts of 5 brothers. But here's Coyote as a beautiful woman.
Coyote and his brother Fox were living in their teepee alone. They were very hungry. They hunted and continued to hunt, but without success. Each sundown they failed. Each sundown they returned to their lodge, tired, empty-handed, and more hungry than ever. At last Fox gave up hope. He left Coyote and went to another country in search of food. Coyote remained at home, starving and scheming. Always hungry, he ate everything that he could find, from insects to leaves. At last he got an idea that would bring him food. Nearby was a great encampment of people who hated him. He thought to fool these people and obtain something to stay his growing hunger. In the encampment was a fine-looking young warrior named Badger. Living with his 4 sisters who loved their brother, Badger killed plenty of game, generously giving meat to all the poor. Many of the old wanted him for a son-in-law, but Badger did not fancy any of the maidens among his own people. He wished to find a wife in a far country. One sun, when Badger's sisters went for their daily bath, they saw a beautiful strange woman sitting on the riverbank, painting her face with fine, many-colored paints. The sisters were pleased. They asked the stranger to come to their teepee. They hoped that their warrior brother might accept her as a wife. When Badger reached home from hunting, he was attracted by the strange woman. He asked her to his special seat in the big teepee, accorded only to a wife. She accepted shyly, but that night refused to sleep with Badger. She said to him, "Before I can take you as a husband, I must carry home 4 loads of food for my parents. And each trip your sisters must go with me, all carrying packs of dried meat." To this Badger agreed, and the next day the 5 women carried 4 loads each to the teepee for the supposed old parents. The handsome woman was Coyote himself, who made the 4 sisters wait while he went alone with the food inside the teepee. He told the sisters that the old people did not want to see strangers, pretended to hold talk with the parents, mimicking the voices of the old. When Coyote had all the food stored, he ran away from Badger's sisters, turning himself back into his old self, Coyote. To save their brother's pride, the sisters kept secret Coyote's trick. But a few sundowns later, when Badger went to the sweat house, where some men were ahead of him, he heard them say, "There comes the proud and handsome Badger, he who refused the good women of his own people, who had Coyote for a wife. We don't want a sweat house with him." This made Badger very ashamed, and after chasing Coyote from the country, he humbled himself to his people and took from among them a wife. Badger has ever since been humble among the animals.
The time is just about out, and so I have one more category that I'd like to bring to your attention, and that's the boogeymen of the region. Some of the region's Indian narratives tell of the boogeymen who appear before the region's Indians formed as ogres, monsters, demons, or evil dwarf-like creatures. In particular, water monsters inclined to cannibalism are acknowledged by the Indians. Accounts tell of one such monster who inhabits Lake Chelan and other regional bodies of water. When you're on the Lady of the Lake leaving, be careful. Still another class of monsters lives in the mountains. These are giants, real giants who step from one mountain peak to another, more than 20 feet tall. These mountain giants usually wear no clothes but are covered with hair. They live in caves in the mountains and are believed to devour unwary Indians. Other monsters include a swallowing monster whose heart Coyote severed from his body, an evil old woman with a basket, or little people with round mouths. And there are even the shadow people who live in the place of the dead. And of course, there is Enumclaw Pa, or the Thunderbird. Next time you go through Enumclaw, Washington, that's the place of the Thunderbird. In recent years, the Sasquatch has become a popular fare for the press and for others. And while we can speculate that perhaps the Indians of the region anthropomorphized or provided some sort of animal explanation for thunder from visual sightings of the great California condor, and thus came up with Enumclaw Pa, or even the soaring golden eagle, which is native to the region, no such speculation has been engaged in by Sasquatchers. I've looked in vain for scientific bases, you see, and find nothing. Instead, imaginative accounts or inventions are simply rendered by the Sasquatchers as tangible fact. But the fact is that no gorilla-like animals are recounted in all the published tales of the inland Pacific Northwest Indians, and I've searched even through the Smithsonian. Even more, no historical incidence of such animals has been reliably evidenced in archaeological digs in the region. And no scientific accounts by zoologists or wildlife biologists can account for mutations which transform an African species into a North American animal. No widespread and compelling accounts of these animals can be found to lend weight to the supposition that Indians, hunters of the regions, were well acquainted with such a beast. And as I think we mentioned yesterday, hunger in the winter drove the Indians far. They were expert trackers, and we find no mention of the Sasquatch. Instead, we find a solitary scrap of language here, an unreliable or confused oral account there. These are rendered out of proportion, provide no substantive database, provide no substantiation for the Sasquatch. So, we have a tale here of how Garter Snake now as the hero, scared Thunderbird out of his feathers.
Every snow, Thunderbird of the snowland came to devour the fairest of the virgins among the villages. It was the custom that the maiden go out to meet the monster, to be eaten for the sake of her tribe. Thunderbird was satisfied to leave the people unmolested so long as he was given this yearly sacrifice. But it must be at his first appearance from the snowland, at his first rolling among the clouds. No one had ever been able to scare Thunderbird, could not frighten him from his human feast. With the spring there was wailing for the victim. At last Gartersnake thought that he would try to meet Thunderbird. The maiden chosen to perish was one that Gartersnake loved. When she left the village crying, going to her terrible death, Gartersnake put on his best war bonnet and followed her. The maiden saw him. She begged him to return, lest he be killed. Gartersnake said, "No, I am going to die with you." She said to Gartersnake, "Go back to our people. You cannot stand before Thunderbird. I alone will die." But Gartersnake would not turn back. Soon he heard the flapping of great wings. It was Thunderbird coming. Gartersnake's legs shook with fear. He wanted to run away, but his pride, his love for the girl, made him brave. He met Thunderbird without revealing that he was afraid. Thunderbird spit fire, spit lightning towards Gartersnake. Gartersnake did not run. He spit fire back at Thunderbird. This stopped Thunderbird. Thunderbird thought, "This must be someone more powerful than I to spit fire as I do." Thunderbird said to Gartersnake, "What do you fear? What are you afraid of?" Gartersnake answered, "I fear nothing. Nothing can hurt me. If you wish to fight, I will show you how big a fire I can spit." These words Thunderbird believed, for none of the tribes had dared to meet him before. Only the timid maidens who came crying to their death had ever faced him. Thunderbird spit a bigger fire, thinking to scare Gartersnake, but Gartersnake spit a great fire streaming in the face of Thunderbird. This soon scared Thunderbird, who turned towards his snow country home. Gartersnake followed him, spitting fire as he chased the big Thunderbird. Gartersnake said to him after driving him home, "From this day you will never come back to our land to devour the people. You will only roam the skies, only make rumblings and crashings amid the storm gathering." Since that time, Thunderbird has kept away from the people. He was ashamed because Gartersnake had driven him away with spitting fire. He never came back to destroy the tribes of the warm countries. He could only fly through the upper space, only clash his broad wings among the clouds, spitting fire from his great mouth. Gartersnake went back to his people with the maiden whom he had saved. For his bravery in protecting the tribes from Thunderbird, for scaring away the mighty air monster with his pretended power, they gave Gartersnake a pretty green blanket with stripes. This garb Gartersnake wears to this day.
Well, we have several other categories. Coyote the Trickster and the Bungling Host. And the story might briefly be summed up as Coyote, it's midwinter and he's very hungry, and so he goes to the house of Bear for a meal. And Coyote is accompanied by his young son, young Coyote, who's very long-suffering. And of course there's Coyote's wife, Mouse, who every time old Coyote sets out to do something, raises her eyes to heaven because the old boy, he's going to get in the jackpot. But we go to Bear's house, and there's no food, no furnishings. But Bear receives them. Coyote is yawning. So Bear says, "Sit, we shall have food." And we get some insight into Indian humor, because what Bear does is reach for a knife and lop off one of his wife's breasts. And Coyote is taken aback because Bear takes some ashes, heals the wound, but then puts the meat on the broil. And next, Coyote backs up to a bark basket and defecates into it. And defecates into it. Well, you know, the Cordon Bleu in Paris or Delmonico's in San Francisco with Blue Fox was never like this, and so on. And he is not going to put up with this. This is ridiculous. How dare Bear be so insulting?